And now, Pack Hollywood Hour Top 10 with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
All right, Dean Haglund, you just asked me if I'd heard the news about the death of beloved character actor Bill Paxton.
Yes, I did. I didn't know how information was traveling through the internet.
And my answer was, what? Of course I heard the news. And your follow-up question was...
Were you at the hospital?
Because clearly the morgues all throughout North America and actually the industrialized world immediately, they have Chilpack Hollywood Hour on speed dial. because really, you come to us first for news, views, and analysis about celebrity deaths, do you not?
Well, it seems lately it's been a lot of celebrity death episodes, I'm going to tell you.
That's true. That's absolutely true. I'm riding some levels here, people, so don't worry.
Oh, yeah.
You're hearing some. And Dean's going to talk squarely into the microphone, and everything will be fantastic for this special installment of your Chillpack Hollywood Hour. So we'll talk about Bill Paxton next week. We'll talk about, the Oscars next week. We will talk about, one of the great, great movies, a front runner for best film of the year. And if, honestly, a year from now... the Academy is interested in, really not being hashtag Oscar so white. They will nominate Jordan Peele's directorial debut, the horror film Get Out. They will nominate it for Best Picture of the year. So we'll talk about all these things on next week's show, but we have a very special episode today. It is, unless I am... tragically mistaken, it's our seventh top 10 show of this year 10 of your Chillpack Hollywood Hour.
Wow, look at us. And it's only what, March, February? So look at us go. We're nailing this.
The ones we have left, of course, our top 10 most overlooked science fiction films of all time. Top 10, and we're not sure exactly how to describe this yet, but let's just call them visual artists. Top 10 visual artists of all time. And then our top 10 favorite, most remembered, most memorable episodes of your Chillpack Hollywood Hour. And that will wrap out year 10 of the show.
Yeah, absolutely. That'd be fantastic.
So,
but this isn't that.
No, this is a fascinating... I'm already calling it a fascinating show, and we should really stop screwing around and get to it. We made a movie. Dean, and we've made a few, actually.
We made a few, yeah, but this is one we did. I guess it came out in 2009, but...
No. It did not come out in 2009, Dean.
We shot it in 2009. The year was 2009.
2009 was when we started shooting the film. The film, The Truth Is Out There, our documentary that is equal parts comedy, consciousness, and conspiracy, had its world premiere in, I think it was April 30th. It might have been May 1st. But it was the night after the royal wedding in in London at the British Film Institute there as part of Sci-Fi London. It was also, 2 days after or the day after the capture of bin Laden. So it was quite an interesting weekend to be in London, to be having the world premiere of the film, a world premiere at which Dean Hagland wears suit and tie, and Phil Lernis, who rolls out of bed in a suit and tie, is wearing a T-shirt.
The irony.
So I am always reminded of a, when I think about The Truth Is Out There, of a particular experience I had when we were shooting the film, and it was someone coming up to me and asking me at one of the conventions, one of the events, and they were asking actually about the podcast, and they queried me with this. They said, maybe you'll remember this, because we've talked about this on the show, I think, before, I think when it happened, but they asked, do you guys do your podcast to promote your movie, or are you making the movie to promote the podcast? And I was amused by this for a couple reasons. First of all, because it assumed that promotion is part of it, one way or the other.
Right.
That's part of our aim. And I think to our detriment, that's actually not been ever true. But
promotion's a, it's a big challenge.
But
I'm not gonna lie to you.
But it really did, ask. It really made me wonder, which is it? Which is the driving impulse here? And of course, I think all these years later, and once the film was done, probably even, you realize. Certainly I did, that you can't extricate them, that they're both drawn from the same impulse, making these particular movies, making this podcast, and that is a desire to engage in conversation.
Conversation, to relate, communicate, be part of the thing.
To be part of the thing, to be part of the thing, yes. If only people could hear how eloquent you were when explaining to me why I was creating electrical shorts in our mixing board last week. If they could have heard that, they would be so impressed with Professor Dean Hagland. Less so when they hear sociologist Dean Hagland talking about our desire to participate in the thing. Although...
Okay, mockery aside.
Mockery aside, the thing... does
it
make an appearance. It does make an appearance, and The Truth Is Out There. The thing.
It does, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Of course it does. It's a very funny, exactly. It's a very, very funny moment.
Only 5 miles from The Thing. You're 3 miles from The Thing.
Yeah.
Here's The Thing.
And it's while you're talking about how you were always advised that perhaps it would be better to just focus on one thing. Okay, we've rambled enough, so here's the thing.
Right.
Oh my God, our worst, oddest, most delightful opening ever. But what?
Sure, yeah.
Let's just count down our 10 favorite moments from the opening of today's show. It's top 10 things that occur to us now when we watch The Truth Is Out There. And this is a really good time to be doing it because, of course, we're involved actively in the making of the long-awaited follow-up to The Truth Is Out There, which might be called The Truth Is Out There Too, or, as I'm beginning to really like it, The Truth Is Still Out There. So... The Truth Is Out There today.
Well,
looking at that film, do you want to get us started with an overview or just your number 10 of what occurs to you?
Gosh, that's the thing. When I was sort of numbering all of these things, they're all interconnected. There's no one thing that goes, well, this stands out, this stands out, this stands out. It's, oh my God, here's the whole rigmarole. So I'll start from the most superficial to get to the larger sociological, philosophical elements of it.
I kind of do the same because the film does that to a degree. It's kind of sneaky how it seems to be starting superficial and then gets to really the superficial of personality and then gets to the real depth of personality by the end of it. Also mine is going to be a little bit more, if people want to follow along with the movie and use this as an audio commentary, it will be, mine will be a little bit in kind of chronological order of how these things appear in the movie itself.
Oh, see, I'm not sure. Mine will be in chronological order because so much of it is all over.
But the movie itself, as we'll talk about, is something that embodies a quantum consciousness, a spherical consciousness. And why should this show talking about it, Joe Back Hollywood Hour, be any different? You're going to have to hold, as you do, as the viewer of The Truth Is Out There must, you're going to have to hold perhaps multiple topics, multiple conversations at one time and see how they feed each other, which honestly is what we've been doing for 10 years almost now on Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, where we will take up a conversation and then come back to it weeks, if not months, maybe even years later, as we're doing right here.
Exactly.
So what's the first thing? Number 10, Dean Haglund.
The first thing, let's see. Well, I'm surprised at how young I look. I thought I wasn't aging, but I see this thing go, holy crap, that wasn't even that long ago. And there you go. Time has taken a toll, but
time takes a toll, and I was reminded of this. And it really struck me. Time takes a toll on you in that year that we're shooting.
I know, because you see, here we're starting it, and then when we're finally in London, and I think it's Chicago or whatever. You could see a difference.
No, and when you're in Vancouver and British Columbia, I mean, it is taking a toll on you. It is clear. And that's one of the reasons that we had the length that we do of the film, when people said, oh, it might be more commercially viable if you cut it down, if you do this. But there needed to be this sense for the audience that undertaking a journey for the truth, as fun and rewarding as it is, does not come without its fair share of energetic cost.
Well, and you could see that in all the people we talked to, actually.
And I think,
you know, a lot of them.
And I think the viewers experience that by virtue of the length and scope of the movie, right? If we'd made it easier.
So you're saying the movie ages them.
Well, no, but the movie, again, just like with the spherical nature of its structure, the movie embodies the message. And
to be able to
follow the movie and get everything out of it that's in there, and I don't think that's possible in one view. I don't think I'm still doing it, right? It's a bit each time I watch it. You have to embody the tools that the film is advocating in order to be able to get the most out of the movie. And you have to withstand what can be exhausting at times, if you're really going to commit to this search for what it means to find the truth.
Exactly. And then, you know, Jordan Maxwell, in the beginning of the film, full of energy, jokes, laughing. And then when we get to him at the hotel in Laughlin, Nevada, he seems much more world-weary and beaten down.
There are counters to that, though. Like, our alien sculptress. When we first meet her, she's lovely. But she seems to be a little fragile. And then when we run into her again near the end of the film, oh my God, she's so strong.
Grounded.
She seems so healthy. So anyway, my number 10, Dean, is the film begins, of all things, with the voice of Alex Jones. And it was just this kind of lighthearted way to introduce you. And yet I'm immediately struck by how prescient the editing of the film was, both in terms of the narrative structure, which I've always already referred to and which we'll discuss more, and the organization of it. I mean, to begin with Alex Jones and the Lone Gunman, the two sides of the conspiracy coin, because they represent, to me, the dual themes of power and powerlessness, and community and friendships. On the one hand, Alex Jones, who rails against the powerlessness that people find them in by taking on what he perceives to be the hidden powers that be. And then we have this other visual image of the three of you together, and what you represented on television, of course, was a family that came together over something as simple as a shared desire to find the truth. And this family of the lone gunman was formed. And, oh, by the way, in real life, a genuine lifelong friendship was formed by those actors.
Sure.
So so I'm struck by how prescient the editing is, because it's an unconscious process to a large degree when you're formulating this. And here we have also, by the way, Alex Jones, who has never been, for better or worse, more relevant than he is now, with the ear of the president, President Trump, getting apparently regular phone calls from President Trump. And, oh, by the way, the X-Files is back. You know?
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, exactly. So the
yin-yang of it that I chose to begin with, because I just thought it was such an easy, entertaining introduction of you, turns out to be very prescient. And that pleases me. I wish I could say, oh, these are things that 6 years from now are going to be really important in the conversation. But that's not how you do it. If you approach it from what's going to be important rather than what resonates with you as the authentic way to begin, you know, you have to trust that that unconscious process. So and finally, as it sets up those two parallel themes, on the conspiracy coin, the power and community, it also alludes to the third rail, which is the Jungian awakening to the dream of life. Which Bruce alludes to, and then, of course, later Tucker will allude to. So anyway, what's your number nine, Dean Haglund?
Well, you bring up Alex Jones, and this, to me, has been I don't know if it's a tough thing for me, but I feel somehow some moral responsibility for Trump getting into power by being on Alex Jones' show and giving him legitimacy, which at one time in his apolitical days, when he went after, you know, every political power, and there was the Bilderberg group and the Davos group and, you know, all of these power structures that he was fighting against, now embracing the power structure, you know, the concept of power corrupting.
Right.
And absolute power corrupting. Absolutely. Here, I thought, well, you know, Alex Jones seems to be quite the fighter and all that. But now it seems like he's so embraced a political ideology that it sort of negates all his previous whatever he was onto or whatever he was talking about. And I find that so troubling, morally troubling, that it's really hard to watch the Alex Jones or even hear Alex Jones segments now for me, only because it feels like such a sellout, you know, if you listen to his shows, like in the beginning where it was, you know, he spoke of there will be a need for these political structures to come down, but not by putting in a ridiculous, retarded billionaire who's part of that Bilderberg group, Davos group. Just he's very bad at it, you know, so you didn't find your Mr. Smith, you know, goes to Washington. You didn't find your Jimmy Stewart.
But I think it's still you're now starting to circle back on your point. I think the point was, regardless of who Trump is, if he was a genuine truth seeker and was motivated by the desire to hold secret power accountable, that battle does not end if suddenly, oh, well, wait a minute. Now the secret power that I like is in there.
Right.
It should be about accountability 100% of the time.
Absolutely. And there's nowhere, like if you're looking at InfoWars today and looking at it now, every massive, what would have been a conspiracy or would have been a blatant false flag, you know, whatever it would have been if that guy had been a long-term politician, that guy Trump, Alex Jones would have been all over it. Now, everything is excused as the Illuminati. The powers that be are undermining Trump's ability to do whatever by saying he's not going to go to the White House Correspondents' Dinner or something like
that. Right, right.
So you're using the exact same argument that you'd had before to now defend the undefendable.
Okay.
And so now here, this goes back then to the whole title, The Truth is Out There. And I said this on an interview, you know, I was sort of flipping about it, but it was also back from my arts and context classes at university, that truth, they would ask me, oh, is the truth out there? And I would always say, well, it is, the truth is subjective. So it's something is true for everyone, but everybody's truth is different.
It's relative to our unique experience.
Absolutely. So
and
it
perception.
Is also therefore
and perception.
And perception.
And what we
so
perceive, what we perceive is what we experience, and what we experience is what we believe. Yes. Although there are people
right.
who refuse to believe what they experience, and therefore they don't
yes.
perceive it. It's this interesting train back and forth. I'm going to leap in while we're talking
yeah.
about this to my number nine, because we
okay,
have 17
do.
More to get to in the final 30 minutes of the show.
Well, that was like 2.5 of mine.
Okay,
right
well,
there,
but you got to count them down, man. Number nine
okay.
for me, is interestingly enough, seems to not relate at all to Alex Jones and this fight for the power, but you've brought up the theme that in some part bridges this gap, and it's about the introduction of the master plant ayahuasca. We had no idea that this kind of shamanic peyote dropping otherworld transport
Same.
Was going to become a major theme in the film, and it keeps coming up. And for
yeah.
those people that don't know, the master plant ayahuasca, it activates the DMT secretion in the pineal gland, something that mm-hmm. naturally does secrete at certain moments in one's life, especially near-death experiences. It has been
right.
Suggested that any idea of stories about afterlife are merely from people who survive near-death experiences, and it was the pineal gland giving you this experience to calm you and relax you so that death isn't, you know, so horrible for you. However,
right.
These experiences are so symbolic and so specific to the viewer
yeah.
that, you know, to say that it would necessarily calm someone, well, that depends on what stories you hear. But,
right, exactly.
But anyway, I like this, the introduction of it through your nephew. And
yeah.
again, it was something we didn't necessarily expect, but we weren't going after specific things. We were asking questions.
Right.
And one of the things that came forward is this third rail again of shamanism. You know, the shamanic path of looking into the dark for answers, to find the
yes.
light by looking into the dark. And I think this speaks to, you know, again, this issue of truth is subject. The universal truth, as Bill Tiller says, is that all truth is subjective because we're each the subject experiencing it. And that's not to say there aren't facts, but as I've said before, facts are not in and of themselves truths. Truths
Right.
are something that one can embody and live by. Facts are things you use to build, hopefully, a process of living that is aligned with a truth.
Ah, see, that's very handy.
So
then it comes back to alternative facts are then an alignment of one's subjective truth from one's experience,
well,
whether they believe it or not.
Well, I want to stay out of the political conversation of now since we're talking
yeah,
about
I know.
A movie from then. But we have said this before, that the reason that it's one reason it's important to let people speak their truth. And one reason it was important for me when people would criticize saying, but you never corrected them. And I would say, well, I wasn't
right.
making a documentary about me traveling the world telling people they're wrong. That's not what I was documenting. I was documenting a film about seeking what it means to search for the truth. How do you embody that? And hopefully, what's your responsibility if you feel you have found a truth and can embody it? So one thing about letting people speak, even if, okay, factually they might be in error, is if you know that they are not quote-unquote lying to you, if you know that they are speaking what they believe, even if it's factually wrong, those errors, and honestly, even their lies, reveal great truth about the people who are speaking them. So you still learn really valuable things by listening.
Exactly. And that was on my list. Let's push that up to say it's my number seven. Number eight. And it's this thing about listening. And we called it an information blizzard then. I call it an e-hurricane now. I mean, it's only increased in volume. How much we yell at each other, how much our comments online are, you're an idiot. And that the concept of listening seems to have degraded to a point where it's a luxury that few afford or have the skill to do anymore.
I teach acting classes, as you know, and one of the hardest things to get actors to do, and it's maybe the most critical thing to giving a good performance in the moment, is listening and being affected by what you're hearing. You are describing how so many people walk through the world and we feel like we can't allow ourselves to be affected by what we're hearing. It's just too much. It's just too big. It's just too fast.
Overwhelming.
And so we don't want to be affected. So really, we're not listening at all. And the odd thing is how many actors, their impulses is to not listen and be affected. It's as if what the other person is saying is what happens before it's my turn to speak. Well, that describes so much of cultural dialogue, what passes for cultural dialogue. That is not acting. The key to acting is listening and being affected. That's what it means to pick up on your cues. And and I think our film does a good job of picking up on its cues. And my number eight is improv. Desire to include your improv skills and training at the beginning of the film, and how much not only those skills are what's required for navigating our contemporary culture, but also literally the skill of holding the tension of the opposites, of being able to hear a truth, a belief, a set of alternative facts, and being okay with holding it and not needing to debate it, because as long as you are listening, you are going to keep learning more. And when the moment is right, trusting your ability to pick up on your cues, that's what you do in building an hour-long improv show. As you say, there is no saying no to anything. There is no deflecting or blocking. There is no bad idea. There is just an idea that might not come in handy right now, but I need to hold that because it might be gold later on. And when we premiered The Truth Is Out There in San Jose for the U.S. premiere, we were interviewed beforehand by someone who's become a good friend of ours, Mark Hershon. And he was interviewing us about the movie. But he then asked us during the interview, is it all right if I ask you about the podcast? And so he started asking us some about Chilpak Hollywood Hour. And one of the things he was curious about, really curious, was my background, because he found my conversational style on our show to be embodying of this very improvisational technique that that you do on stage, that you have made a living out of, and he couldn't figure out how does someone who come from behind the scenes and writing embody that. And for me, I said then, and I think it probably is true, you know, I developed it through debate in high school. That was the first time. And really, I've explored it a lot through editing and never did it more than in editing this particular project, right? I had to listen thoroughly to every single conversation and hold all those possibilities so that when someone would say something, I would have a penny drop, and I go, wait a minute, this other person halfway across the world said something either that echoes it, that agrees with it, that directly contradicts it. Let's put that together. Let's make that be a conversation that spans countries, that spans hemispheres, that spans a year or more, maybe. And so those things really developed my and relied upon my own particular version of improv. But again, number eight, just how damn important improv is to navigating the world.
And it's funny because I oscillate sometimes on my improv training in that I go, my ability to say yes to everything means I don't say no to anything. And maybe there is a project or two that I should have said no to so that it's not on my IMDb page.
Well, you...
But at this...
That came up in editing for me. That came up in editing for me. Remember? That was the real thing. How do you include... You have to include the voice of exclusion. I wanted to be thoroughly inclusive, which meant I had to include even the voices that seek to exclude others. Because if I don't, I'm the voice of exclusion. I'm not the voice of inclusion. And I therefore sometimes had to embody exclusion. There had to be certain things that I said, no, we will not include this because this sends the dinner party buffet that is The Truth Is Out There down the wrong track from which it will never recover. It will become a bad party at that moment.
Exactly. And you see this a lot in when you teach improv, somebody says, something, hey, let's burn down this house. And the other person says, no. And then the actor stops the scene and goes, he's blocking because he said no. And I have to point out, he's actually playing the truth. He's accepting that you want to burn down the house, but his character has a thing saying no. He's building a scene is what he's doing. So he's not blocking saying, no, we're not going to burn down the house. We're going to the store. It's, no, we can't burn down this house. That's immoral or whatever. So then the concept of that goes, but the ability to say no in the scene, to say no in improv, doesn't necessarily block or negate what's going on in the scene. So
right.
I think
you're saying yes to saying no in order to keep other possibilities alive. So I think that's really the critical element of this is the no you're saying actually a yes to something else? I'm not going to do this project because I need to keep something else alive. I'm saying yes to something else. And that's really how you have to do that mental and emotional jujitsu.
Right, and it's a duality that you have to embrace. That
holding
is so
the
hard
tension
to teach.
Of the opposites.
Exactly, Dr. Monty, which is my number seven.
Seven.
How great is... I guess it's... It could be six. But
no, but
seven.
We're on
seven.
Number seven, so let's make it number seven.
Let's say make seven, because Dr. Monty, seed it now, realizing the wisdom, at the time, it was like, this is a very good device.
Structural device,
Structural device of getting us from segment to thing to journey, even though everybody's surprised to hear that we filmed that all in a one-hour
shoot. It's one session.
Shoot.
It's one session.
One session.
She does not waste time, that lady.
That lady does not waste time and gets to so many, not just pertinent points, but it, for some reason now when I watch it, it's way more deeply resonant than it was at the moment. So I don't know how she was talking to me 6 years from now, but that lady nailed it on the head.
You know, she's one of those good teachers, and this is true of teachers, whether they're, they can be teachers in school, they can be acting teachers, whatever. The really good ones carry on, I think, two conversations with you, maybe more than that, but always two. One is they're engaging you intellectually, they're engaging your mind. They're having a conversation that's keeping your mind interesting. And meanwhile, the other conversation is one of planting seeds within you so that you can then carry on the conversation with yourself later on. You'll have moments of epiphany where you go, oh, That's what that means. And that's what a really good teacher does, right? The teacher doesn't require you to understand everything when they're teaching it. A good teacher. A good teacher realizes that if you are engaged with them, then all the other seeds have a chance to take root and you know, come to fruition later on. It's also the frustrating thing, though, it's got to be, and you know, at times, is you never get to know. You never get to be there as a teacher, right? You let go of your students, and they go into the world, and you don't get to know. And
subtly, yeah, exactly.
My number seven is at one point near the beginning at Dragon Con, you are asked, and we just do it in a montage of all the different conspiracies you're asked about. We have a quick line, someone asking you about quantum consciousness, the suppression of quantum consciousness, and zero-point energy. And we really have no answer, and we don't truly get into it. By the end of the movie, though, the movie is about becoming a conscious co-creator in the universe. And so quantum consciousness has, it turns out, been what our movie in no small part is about, even though we haven't directly been talking about it. And both that and the zero point will no doubt be significant aspects of part two of our explorations.
Absolutely. And when you think about zero point energy, and this is the, you know, lowest possible energy in a quantum universe, this is also the idea of... that I come back to from the book Chasing the Wild Pendulum, I think, or Stalking the Wild Pendulum, it was called. And an idea that as the pendulum swings, it slows down and transverses a smaller and smaller amount of space. And when it transverses a space so small in the Planck's, I think it's 10 to the minus 132 of a point of a millimeter, then it's supposed to be at zero point energy, where then it has infinite velocity and infinite space, so it can transverse the universe, transverse all time and known. So this idea of going down to the minimalist possible amount of energy to then transverse the infinite is exactly what I noticed with how we go down through the editing and the truth is out there.
Interesting. That's interesting. I mean, we really do break the confines of dimensionality, really. What is your number six, Dean Haglund?
Okay, so, you know, all my painted art, and I think about, is art worth it? Is it useful? What am I doing? You know, you have these discussions with one's own creative process. And then to see Lee McCloskey and how is his work and how it connects to storytelling and what the role of art does is always so re-inspiring on, you know, why we do this, why we go out and bang our head against the wall and why we fight against funding cuts and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And investor bullshit, you know, all of this. It's always so inspiring to see Lee McCloskey and have him discuss his work. And still, you know, at that age, gone through it, gone through the Hollywood mill, still in it, and yet still be so inspired and still be so connected to so many energies and so many levels of creation. It was a joy to see again.
My number six, Dean, comes to us when you and Tucker Smallwood, always one of my favorite on-screen pairings, obviously, three movies now, but when you visit the Nike Protective Shield of Los Angeles, and what I was struck by, again, is you told us when we were going up there about the Battle of Los Angeles. And you were tying it into the history of this Nike Protective Shield. I don't want to go down the rabbit hole on this, but what struck me was how little anyone knows about this Battle of Los Angeles, even though you can go to look at the microfiche on the Los Angeles papers of the day back during World War II era about this aerial battle over Los Angeles. At first, they thought it was Japanese, but of course it wasn't. And it's an amazing, amazing story. And maybe we need to get into that in part two. But while talking about that and being struck by that, I'm also struck again as, you know, all the things that make Trucker such a credible reporter on Area 51, on ideas of aliens versus human, on ideas of zero point, on quantum consciousness, and on other dimensions. What all the things that make him a credible reporter, and I know you agree with me that he's a credible reporter, because, after all, it drove you nuts that, being such a credible reporter, he doesn't do more with the information he has.
Yeah.
And finally, I'll just wrap this up with, you know, what I think is overlooked in so much of the discussion about UFO disclosure and aliens and all of this is that the scary question for people is, if it's not aliens, what is it? That's the question that terrifies. Because if it's men, if it's all man-made, if it's all government, that's terrifying. Because what does that mean in terms of the big blinders that have been put on us? Have they been accessing the zero point, as, you know, Search for Zero Point, a wonderful book? Has the, you know, we've been told, we know this in every field of inquiry, that the economy is always 75 years or more behind the technology. So you want to know what technology we have now, wait 50, 60, 70 years, and then they'll figure it out a way to have made money off of it, and then you'll get to know. So is it that terrifying that people are keeping so much, the powers that be can keep so much hidden from us, and that the media doesn't seek to expose this? So that's terrifying if it's not aliens.
Right.
Or, and even more terrifying, is the quantum consciousness, the multidimensionality aspect of this. Do we share this realm with other beings, but we perceive for the most part that we do not, because we're locked into our three-dimensional way of perceiving things, a way of perceiving things that, as the film argues, as you argue, and as the film actually embodies, it's a way of thinking and perceiving that we are capable of transcending.
Yeah. Interesting, because my number six, technically...
Five. You're number five.
My number five, technically, is the Tucker Smallwood. But also, I realize that I have totally adjusted my attitude, air quotes, over one's need and one's responsibility to share truth and or information that one has. Because, again, quantum consciousness, that ripple does go out whether you are speaking it in a three-dimensional realm or you're thinking it, and that permeates through us all as well. You know, because this idea of ideas then manifesting themselves into our reality is like the 100th monkey theory, right? So this monkey... all these monkeys on these islands in the South Pacific, and they were dropping grain in the sand, and all the monkeys were just eating sandy grain and gritting and in the teeth, they were eating the grit, and one monkey picked up a handful of sand and grain and took it into the water and dropped it, and then ate the clean grain from the ocean as the sand dropped to the bottom. Then suddenly all five islands were doing that. This idea... This hope that the 100th monkey theory will allow us to rise. Unfortunately, I also realize that also bad ideas also permeate the culture.
And, sure, yeah.
And it goes in reverse, right? And so you get alternative facts and darkened political aspects. But
So here's the problem, though, right? In terms of how do you embody the voice of exclusion? To try to seek to silence bad ideas and bad voices, which is what people have been arguing for so long. This leads me right back to, for example, Alex Jones. When I was under attack in London at Goldsmiths College for giving Alex Jones a platform, and I said, yes, it might be dangerous. It might be. I can't argue that giving people a platform, giving them freedom of expression, isn't dangerous. I would be foolish to say it's not. But what I do know from my personal history, from my country's history, from my family's history, is that any time you repress something or suppress it, it's always dangerous. So, yes, you might... the problem of bad ideas, of misinformation, of alternative facts, if we'll call it that, these things are a problem, absolutely. However, you don't want to take the problem and exacerbating it by seeking to suppress it or repress it, because that's an even worse idea. You've just now become what you've beheld. You have found bad ideas, and you've become the bad idea by seeking to repress it. I will say this. My number five is Tucker's responsibility, his feelings of responsibility. And I'm glad that you addressed this, because what was clear to me in watching it this time was what he was saying was it's his responsibility to share what he knows, not what he has experienced. And this gets back to this idea is our experience is based on our reality. And it's either falling in line with that reality or in opposition to it. But our reality is always unique to us. So therefore, he feels no responsibility to share that. He shares what he knows to be true. In other words, the truth he has gleaned from those experiences. And that's very profound. So that's what he shares. And then as you said, and I think we're alluding to, you know, this whole Buddhist concept of be the change you wish to see. Well, by embodying the truth and by embodying your experience and embracing it and doing that work, that which you are does ambiate and, you know, and ripple throughout the collective energetically and in terms of consciousness.
Absolutely. And so that's why I think realizing that and hearing and seeing that again allowed me backed off from that concept of what is responsibility of sharing an experience. And again, as we've seen, sharing an experience also can turn against you. It can demarginalize you. You can be ridiculed for it. In the age where we aren't listening, anything that seems outside the norm of one person is talk to the hand time for anything. So that's why I'm also keen on or more about sharing your truth over sharing the experience.
Right. What's number four for you, Dean?
Well, then it comes to... the interesting Dr. Monteith juxtaposition with Dr. Edward Griffin. And when
Edward Griffin, who you consistently refer to as a doctor, not a doctor. He's a filmmaker and an author. He's not a doctor at all. Remember, he was a salesman and he was not a brilliant guy, but he's not a doctor. So, Dr. Monteith was a medical doctor. He was a foot doctor. And so he was a medical doctor.
Was he a foot doctor?
Yeah, I think he was.
I thought he was a...
Oh, no, Roger Lear was a foot doctor, but it was something. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah, it was something, but, some kind of medical practitioner. I'll try to find that out. But so that juxtaposition between them.
Yes. Okay, so, well, two learned men, let's say, that sit side by side, and how Dr. Monteith now, he was the precursor to anti-vaxxer. It seemed that he was all up on... the mercury in vaccinations and how this is developmentally harming. He was drawing a line between that and child brain development. And then at the same time, Everett Griffin talking about health issues, but they're in nature. And I thought that I didn't realize that that was such an interesting juxtaposition, particularly now in the day and age of so many natural remedies and anti-vaxxers, coming up through websites of a conspiracy ilk, again, air quotes around conspiracy.
So he was a retired orthopedic surgeon. popularly known as Dr. Yeah. Stan. He died in 2014, and that struck me. It's not one of my top 10, but several of the people have died that were generous with their time for us. Dean, interesting how different my number four is, though again, I feel like the tension of the opposites holding that is what this movie is about. Yeah. My number four, right. as you're talking about Dr. Stan and Edward Griffin basically leading us down into the dark space of the New World Order and how the fix is in, and because we're using up too many of their natural resources. I don't mean Dr. Stan and Edward Griffin. I mean the people behind the New World Order. My number four is David Sirita, Dean Haglund, Truth Seekers. The fun that the two of you have side by side shows to me the true nature, maybe true is the wrong word, but the nature of genuine truth seeking. Dr. Stan and Edward Griffin, God bless them, hanging out in their compounds doing their research. We know for Dr. Stan, we know how hard it was for us to get to him, all the security gates and that hidden compound in the mountains.
Yeah.
Right. You know, they're
eating
not...
eating a grapefruit for breakfast, yeah.
They're not out engaging with people and learning about people. They're not out engaging really with nature, even though Dr. Stan's hidden in nature. He's built a compound that keeps nature out, and nature is just a defense field against people finding him. But so this sense of fun, this sense of wanting to be in nature, and this sense of being absolutely delighted with being proven wrong, with having an idea that's proven wrong. The fun that the two of you have proving each other wrong, it's fantastic, right?
Right. Yeah, at one point, David Sirita going, oh, yeah, no, scratch that whole idea. Like, he just gave it a kind of a thoughtful premise on UFOs and what he would like the future to be. And then I posit something, and he goes, oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. Forget that, then. That's what he says. But
forget that, then.
But that's his opening thesis when we see him. It's UFOs don't travel through space. They get out of space. He's talking about a scientific theory about how they could transcend these great distances, right? They get out of space. Mm-hmm. And what I thought was interesting about hearing that theory in this is, isn't that what seeking truth is about? It's about transcending and breaking free from the here and the now, from our immediate experiences, from getting transdimensional in our consciousness, transcending time and space. That's what seeking truth is all about. You don't seek truth by traveling through time. You don't seek truth by traveling through space. You seek truth by getting out of time and out of space. As our dear friend Lee McCloskey says, that's why Plato, his message not only ambiates across the ages, but why it seems like he's writing for each and every one of us right now. He got out of time.
Transcended.
He got out of space.
Got out of time. Right.
So,
and that's the whole, yes. This is...
less than 10 minutes left, Dean. We've got our top three each.
Type three. So... the third one then is the how all of the movie precursed to where we are now in time and space, and how all of this, there were these echoes of politicization that we seem now to be grounded in a left-right, which defines space. Our left and our right side defines the space, but that all of the concepts now are echoed in a politicized sphere of experience, which I find so unfortunate, you know, because when that movie was made, that had less to do with alt-right or a liberal, you know, left concept, and more just about a universal truth that was separate, that was, as you said, transcending time and space. But now it seems that all of that has grounded down, and that... that I find somewhat heartbreaking, frankly. So that's my number three, the heartbreak of watching this in our today's political climate.
My number three involves Doctor Who. Not referred to in the movie at all. But if you'll recall, you made a very good case that I suddenly realized about my block towards enjoying Doctor Who, that in this sense of what is it reflecting and mirroring for me, that it's too close to home, that I am in some fundamental way a time transcending intergalactic violence prevention specialist intervening where things are going wrong, that that's my nature, and therefore I am the Doctor, and therefore I don't enjoy watching the Doctor. If I am Doctor Who, Dean Haglund, then maybe in real life you are a character from Twin Peaks. You played a character from The X-Files, but you are a character from Twin Peaks, and it's this X-Files-Twin Peaks connection that is actually my number three. You have a block where Lynch's work is concerned, and yet you are not in any way opposed to these Jungian ideas and these ideas of transcending into a collective unconscious, into a zero point, into conscious co-creation, which Lynch's work is all about, and never more explicitly than in Twin Peaks, where the Jungian owls are not what they seem is not only a major theme, it's a major plot point. And is echoed by our own Tucker Smallwood, who tells a story about seeing the same owl with the same markings three times while at Area 51 for a week. And so not knowing what he really saw, because it's pretty apparent to him it was a Jungian screen memory. And maybe on next week's show, I'll tell you about my experience with a gigantic owl stalking me on my way home the other night. But there are other connections between X-Files and Twin Peaks. Dean, after all, David Duchovny appears on both shows. We visited the town of Twin Peaks there in Washington, not once, but twice. And both the X-Files and Twin Peaks are back.
I know.
So there are connections between these. And I think the block for you is perhaps a little tongue-in-cheek, but there, but just like there was the block you let me see with Doctor Who, I think there's something for you in this where you played a character in the realm of the X-Files, a character people want to see you as, but you actually live, Dean, in the town of Twin Peaks.
Oh, my gosh. Everything is surreal, I must say. It's funny that you should say that, because last night, going through all the cues on my different streaming, there is the entire series of Twin Peaks, and it somehow, in that AI algorithm, hey, if you enjoyed this, you're going to like that thing, what was number one that I should sit down and binge watch, but Twin Peaks, and then showed up yesterday. I don't know what the hell I was watching, but it said, hey, I think you'd enjoy this show, Mr. Haglund, please sit down and watch it right now. So
I would love if you binge watched this and you could file a report, like a few minutes of each show, do a little recap of one of the episodes. Like, you know, just count them down and do a few minutes. Because I was thinking about doing that with the sequel series. So it would be really interesting to kind of do that.
That would be interesting.
Now, we're running very low on time. What's your number two, Dean?
Number two would be seeing just how much fun the conventions were. I had forgotten. I always see it from the table side, but you exploring Dragon Con and some of the other cons there, I forget what family is, how important the cons are, and makes me really want to go back and hit the road again, which I probably will do
in
the following year.
And we're going to start doing that when you're in Texas in May, right?
Yeah, May 26th. Yeah.
That's going to be great fun. Back UFO with Tom con? And Bruce and me shooting stuff for Truth Is Out There, too. It's going to be very, very exciting. Number two for me is Alex Jones, the name that keeps coming up. And specifically this. We've talked before about how many people leading up to his election and following his election are still quite honestly doing that. How many people who are opposed to Trump take everything he says literally and yet don't take him seriously? And that actually, for me, describes a lot of the the relationship people have to Alex Jones. There are many people who take everything he says literally without taking him seriously. And then the people who do seem to follow, look, there's always an outlier of people who are going to be slavishly devoted to whatever you're saying or doing. But I think most supporters of Alex Jones for the longest time, they took him seriously without the need to take everything he said literally. Because, like you described, they were very much on board with this approach, this almost libertarian approach towards protecting individual liberties against all powers that would seek to suppress and squash them. And if he was cherry-picking a case, if he was hyperbolic in his case, so be it. It doesn't need to be taken literally. The point is a strong one that the battle to protect and preserve and nourish and nurture individual liberties is a struggle that has to be carried out all the time in perpetuity. What strikes me as the real sellout, you use those words, and that really struck me. But this very libertarian approach to the protection of individual liberties now finds its expression in nationalistic rhetoric. In a president who embodies nationalism, look, even if you think New World Order and globalism is the problem, and we've talked about how rampant globalism is behind a lot of these chickens coming home to roost, right? Unchecked globalism. But nationalism is not the answer to globalism. Individualism is the answer to globalism. And national boundaries ought only be relevant to the degree that the nation they denote preserves and protects individual liberties of its entire citizenry.
Exactly. And to have that not referenced anymore is so weird, because that was such the mainstay for so long, so on so many of these shows. And now it seems that either we have forgotten it, or that, again, an e-hurricane is going on. That
e-hurricane. That's my new website, e-hurricane.
That you can't even sit in these philosophical concepts.
It's like e-harmony, Dean. It's a dating site, e-hurricane. It's for those people who find the realities of climate change really impinging upon their romantic life. So it's e-hurricane. How do you find love in a time of global climate crisis?
That's funny you should say that. That's sort of my number one.
Your number one.
My number one is that the ultimate thing that is hopeful about all of this, because, watching it would seem like, oh, my God, this has just gotten darker, as this has resonated in our time of darkness, is to find the light in all this darkness. How many people here are finding light in darkness? And that was necessary to have a dark time like we perhaps are living in for some, that this is where you find the light. And this is where growth can come from. So ultimately, all things happen for a reason. And this becomes the idea that manifests itself into a three-dimensional space-time.
Wow. So it seems like your number one could not be more different than my number one. but wait for it. See, what struck me as number one was not something really in the film. It was so much as it held a mirror up to what's been lacking in our society and our culture. And that is namely that all our institutions, be they political, religious, commercial, entertainment, have all failed us because none of them provide us with the necessary instruction of life. They all speak to, in their own ways, methods of how to live your life, how to get by, how to be healthy, how to make a living, how to be entertained, how to develop your spirituality. But they fail completely in terms of answering why you should live your life. It's this reality that is touched upon by Bill Tiller, Bob Dean, Jordan Maxwell, Lee McCloskey, and others in our film. It's spoken to by something that will be talked about in Truth Is Out There Too, by that fresco atop the rotunda in the U.S. Capitol called The Apotheosis of George Washington. Look it up. If you don't know it, people, there's this crazy fresco, head-scratching fresco that's atop of our congressional dome. It depicts the divine transformation of the father of our country into godlike status. It speaks to the purpose behind this nation's founding. It was a sanctuary state where individual liberties would be established and preserved so that each citizen might pursue their alchemical transformation into the divine being encoded into the very star stuff that makes up all our DNA. At most, people in modern society might be instructed on how to map out their inner life and bridge the seeming gulf with that inner landscape and our outward experiences. But the shamans who advise us to look into the dark, the prophets who seek to awaken us to the illusion of life, they advise us all that there is no difference between what is within and what is without. That when we learn about things in the world that we don't like, we're learning about the things within ourselves that we don't like. That when we learn about millions of other galaxies, right? Millions of other galaxies and probably millions of Earth-like planets out there that we can never hope to explore, right? We can never hope to explore them.
Yeah.
But we learn about them as a mirror reminding us that each of us contain truly infinite space within ourselves and our consciousness. That as above, so below, that as within, so without. And perhaps by looking to the various mystery schools of the past, we might finally reclaim our rightful inheritance, namely an instruction to our own unique personal apotheosis.
Absolutely. And walk away from the false narrative of a broken culture and develop a new story. As Lee McCloskey said, we have to have a new story.
Well,
new narrative.
He says so eloquently, right, that when the cultural conversation is not nourishing, it's incumbent upon each of us to start our own and to create space for that. This is the reason for the critic who reviewed Chilpak Hollywood Hour all those years ago when we were making the film and said that our show is simply, even though we're both very smart, interesting guys, it's just to promote the movie we're making, which wasn't true at all. It's just that was so encompassing. That's what we had to talk about. And the answer to that criticism and the answer to the question of are we doing the movies to drive the show or the show to drive the movies? 10 years in, and I'm only starting to realize now that we do this because, as Lee McCloskey advised, we have carved out space to have a more nourishing cultural conversation, at least for each other, and hopefully for the loyal and oh so easy on the eye listeners that comprise Chilpak Nation.
Right, and they can find some shows, actually all of them now, thanks to you. At chillpackhollywood.com.
Right. Download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes.
Absolutely. So easy. Even review on iTunes. That's fun.
What could be more fun? Like us
and
on Facebook.
Follow us on Facebook.
Yeah.
Yes. We're facebook.com/chillpackhollywood. Poke us, like us, do all those things that you do.
Write us, won't you? Write us, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. Let us know what you want us to discuss. Dean, can people follow us on Twitter and on Instagram?
With the very same handle, Dean and Phil, spell out the word and.
That is so exciting. Okay, we'll be back next week to talk so much show business stuff. We promise to keep it, for the most part, within the time and space continuum. Until next week, I'm Phil Lairness.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.